Good evening. A political crisis in Virginia. The president invokes a so-called socialism menace while Congress broadens its probe of Russiagate and Trump's business dealings. The feds challenge plans for a supervised ejection site in Philadelphia, and women gather to watch the speech in New York City. With these and other stories, I'm Paul DiRienzo with the WBAI Evening News for Wednesday, February 6, 2019. The political crisis in Virginia spun out of control Wednesday when the state's attorney general confessed to putting on blackface in the 1980s, and a woman went public with detailed allegations of sexual assault against the lieutenant governor. With Governor Ralph Northam's career already hanging by a thread over a racist photo in his 1984 medical school yearbook, the day's developments threatened to take down all three of Virginia's top elected officials, all of them Democrats. The twin blows began with Attorney General Mark Herring issuing a statement admitting he wore brown makeup and a wig in 1980 to look like a rapper during a party when he was a 19-year-old student at the University of Virginia. Herring, who had previously called on Northam to resign and was planning to run for governor himself in 2021, apologized for his callous behavior and said that the days ahead will make it clear whether I can or should continue to serve. The 57-year-old Herring came clean after rumors about the existence of a blackface photo of him began circulating at the Capitol, though he made no mention of a picture on Wednesday. Then, within hours, Vanessa Tyson, the California woman whose sexual assault allegations against Lieutenant Governor Justin Fairfax surfaced earlier this week, put out a detailed statement saying Fairfax forced her to perform oral sex on him in a hotel room in 2004 during the Democratic National Convention in Boston. The Associated Press typically does not identify those who say they were sexually assaulted, but Tyson issued the statement in her name. Tyson, a 42-year-old political scientist who is on a fellowship at Stanford University and specializes in the political discourse of sexual assault, said, "I have no political motive. I'm a proud Democrat." She went on to say, "Mr. Fairfax has tried to brand me as a liar to a national audience in service to his political ambitions and has threatened litigation." She added, "Given his false assertions, I'm compelled to make clear what happened." Fairfax, who is in line to become governor if Northam resigns, has repeatedly denied her allegations, saying the encounter was consensual and that he's the victim of a strategically timed political smear. And while Republicans and many Democrats rose and enthusiastically applauded President Donald Trump's attack on socialism during his State of the Union address Tuesday night, Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who, along with Senator Bernie Sanders, remained seated, said the president's remarks showed he's scared of the progressive policies that most Americans are embracing. During his State of the Union speech, Trump linked events in Venezuela, where the U.S. is backing an attempted coup against the elected leader, Nicolas Maduro, with socialism.
2 weeks ago, the United States officially recognized the legitimate government of Venezuela and its new president, Juan Guaido. We stand with the Venezuelan people in their noble quest for freedom, and we condemn the brutality of the Maduro regime, whose socialist policies have turned that nation from being the wealthiest in South America into a state of abject poverty and despair. Here in the United States, we are alarmed by the new calls to adopt socialism in our country. America was founded on liberty and independence, and not government coercion, domination, and control. We are born free, and we will stay free.
Representative Ocasio-Cortez responded that Trump's zero-tolerance immigration policies are failing and that he's looking for a scapegoat, blaming socialism.
I think that he needs to do it because he feels like He feels himself losing on the issues. Every single policy proposal that we have adopted and presented to the American public has been overwhelmingly popular, even some with a majority of Republican voters supporting what we're talking about. When we talked about a 70% marginal tax rate on incomes over $10 million, 60% of Americans approve it. 70% of Americans believe in improved and expanded Medicare for all. A very large amount of Americans believe that we need to do something about climate change and that it is an existential threat to ourselves and to our children. And so I think he sees himself losing on the issues. He sees himself losing on the wall and on the wall on the southern border. And he needs to grasp at an ad hominem attack. And this is his way of doing it. But what we really need to realize that what is happening is that this is an issue of authoritarian regime versus democracy. And in order for him to try to, you know, dissuade or throw people off the scent of the trail, he has to really make and confuse the public. And I think that that's exactly what he's trying to do.
And economist Richard Wolff adds that Trump is distracting voters and the public from the failures of capitalism to benefit American workers who are now turning to socialist alternatives.
Mr. Trump, the biggest single cause of Americans' interest in socialism is because the economy, the capitalist economy you represent, hasn't worked real well for the majority of people. The inequality you inherited and made worse has increased the interest in socialism. You don't like socialism. You're the biggest booster of it in this country. You're the one. Your blindness to what is going on, your fakery in order to promote yourself politically, is in a way the most dangerous misunderstanding and misleadership that this society cannot now afford, given what is happening to it.
Trump's 90-minute speech restated his well-known positions on building a wall, even as he called for unity with Democrats. He congratulated himself for decreasing unemployment figures, threatened Iran, and claimed he's achieving peace with North Korea. At one point in the speech, he spoke about the continuing investigations targeting his administration as undermining peace.
The only thing that can stop it are foolish wars, politics, or ridiculous partisan investigations. If there is going to be peace and legislation, there cannot be war and investigation. It just doesn't work that way.
On Wednesday, Trump further denounced House Intelligence Committee Chairman Adam Schiff.
He's just a political hack who's trying to build a name for himself, and I think that's fine because that's what they do. But there would be no reason to do that. No other politician has to go through that. It's called presidential harassment, and it's unfortunate, and it really does hurt our country.
Earlier Wednesday, Schiff said he would launch a probe that extends beyond alleged links between the Trump campaign and Russia that would examine whether Trump's decisions as president have been motivated by financial gain.
I want to address the president's remarks last night, his effort to discourage any meaningful oversight of the administration. That's a non-starter. We are not going to be intimidated or threatened by the president to withhold any legislative advancement. If we do our proper oversight, we're going to do our proper oversight. I can fully understand why the president has gotten used to the idea that Congress doesn't do oversight, because for the last 2 years, the Republican majority has essentially been missing in action when it comes to being a co-equal branch of government. But that ended with the midterms. We're going to do our jobs. The president needs to do his. And our job involves making sure that the policy of the United States is being driven by the national interest. So we're going to do our work, and that work began in earnest today. Our first committee action was to authorize the transmission of all of the transcripts to the special counsel from the conduct of the Russia investigation thus far. That includes transcripts that the special counsel and the Justice Department have not yet had access to, and a great many that they have, but have not been allowed to use for particular purposes, including in prosecutions for false statement or obstruction or perjury or any other like offense.
Schiff's House Intelligence Committee voted Wednesday to send transcripts for more than 50 interviews the committee conducted in its investigation of alleged ties between the Trump campaign and Russia in the 2016 election. They would be sent to justice. Multiple committee Republicans confirmed the unanimous vote to release the transcripts. Schiff said they could be used for any purpose which would facilitate justice, but would not say whether the special counsel had formally requested any of the transcripts for official use. The committee voted on December 20th to formally submit a transcript of longtime Trump advisor Roger Stone's testimony to the special counsel after receiving an official request for the transcript. The California Democrat also announced a delay in the upcoming closed-door interview with Trump's former fixer and personal lawyer, Michael Cohen, in the interests of the investigation. The interview was originally scheduled for Friday. It will now be held on February 28th. Both Cohen and Trump's longtime advisor, Roger Stone, have been charged with lying to the panel. Cohen pleaded guilty in November to lying to the House and Senate Intelligence Committees about his role in a Trump business proposal in Moscow. He acknowledged that he misled lawmakers by saying he had abandoned the project in January 2016 when he actually continued pursuing it for months after that. Stone pleaded not guilty to charges last month that he lied to the House panel about his discussions during the 2016 election about WikiLeaks, the anti-secrecy group that released thousands of emails stolen from Democrats. Stone is also charged with obstructing the House probe by encouraging one of his associates, New York radio host Randy Credico, to refuse to testify before the House panel in an effort to conceal Stone's false statements. Among the transcripts are interviews with Trump's eldest son, Donald Trump Jr., his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, his longtime spokeswoman, Hope Hicks, and his former bodyguard, Keith Schiller. There are dozens of other transcripts of interviews with former Obama administration officials and Trump associates. WBAI covered the State of the Union message on Tuesday. Host Carmen Berkley spoke with foreign policy analyst Phyllis Bennis with the Institute for Policy Studies. Bennis compared Trump to a broken clock.
It's going to be right twice a day. That doesn't mean the clock isn't broken. You know, and you have to be really careful that when you see that it happens by chance, to have the right time, that you don't start depending on the clock. Here you have Trump talking about Holocaust survivors and segueing again to the killings, the horrific killings, the real anti-Semitic killings in Pittsburgh some months ago. And in that context, it's sort of this diversion away from where does the real threat come from for Jews in this country? What is the real position of Iran in the region? We didn't hear anything, for example, about Saudi Arabia. We didn't hear, certainly, about the Saudi killing of Jamal Khashoggi.
Yes.
We didn't hear about the war against Yemen. We never heard the word Yemen mentioned, which is, of course, talked about as an example of Iranian-Saudi competition or contention in the region. But what is really being ignored is the extraordinary, horrific humanitarian crisis that is facing the people of Yemen right now, where there's been over 16,000 people killed directly in the war. There's over a million cases of cholera, the largest outbreak of cholera anywhere in the world because clean water is no longer available. And the UN has said that 20 million people are on the verge of starvation. So this is what we're not hearing about. What we heard from Trump in his State of the Union speech, we had no details about what any of this actually meant. He talked about the only specific he raised, and I've forgotten this one. He said that there would be 3,750 additional troops sent to the border. This is his view of, you know, how you deal with foreign policy, is send more troops to deal with the so-called onslaught of desperate refugees approaching the United States. And again, he was sort of bragging about that. He bragged about the U.S. military being the most powerful on earth. Not a word about what happens when you militarize all of your foreign policy.
Correct. And, so, you know, one thing I wanted to, you know, interject and ask you about is, you know, some of the false claims and the conflating of information. One thing that he said is, while talking about the weaknesses of socialism in Venezuela, President Trump said, "We are alarmed by new calls to adopt socialism in our country." I'm interested to talk a little bit more about, you know, these claims around socialism in Venezuela. And as a matter of fact, just to take one pause, we have Sue Goodwin here, who is our political expert here in WPFW Washington, D.C., to do a little bit of fact checking.
Well, actually, I'm just conveying the work that, again, our expert fact checker, Viraj Patel, gave us tonight. And Phyllis, I really do want to hear your reaction to this. The president said that if he were not president, we would now be in a major war with North Korea.
Yeah, that was a rather extraordinary thing. It was not happening that there was this move towards war in North Korea before Trump came in. There had been tensions with North Korea. There had been periods of greater tensions, periods of greater collaboration between the two countries. But the notion that we would have somehow been on the verge of a major war is simply made up. I mean, it just has no connection to reality. The reality right now is that, again, coming back to our little clock analogy, you know, when the clock is right once in a while, twice a day, maybe the idea of developing ties in terms of talking, actual negotiations with regimes that have long been considered outside the pale, that U.S. officials were not allowed to speak to, that sort of thing, including North Korea, in my view, is a good thing. Negotiations have to start there. The fear that I have right now is that the closer we get to something that looks like a real move towards peace with North Korea, because that doesn't exist yet. The U.S. is still occupying South Korea with thousands of troops. It's still a very tense situation. The very real threat of direct U.S. intervention, which will threaten the possibility of regional war, threaten the possibility of a civil war inside Venezuela. The situation is really quite threatening. There are tremendous challenges inside Venezuela. I think many people believe that the current government has made numerous mistakes that have put at risk some of the incredible accomplishments of the revolutionary process, of the Bolivarian Revolution, of Hugo Chavez. But the notion that somehow U.S. intervention is the answer to any of these problems simply turns it on its head. It ignores the impact of sanctions, which, of course, are making the desperate situation in Venezuela dramatically worse, making food and medicine even harder to obtain. So this notion that somehow the U.S. has recognized the legitimate president, this is a man who was never elected to be president, is a brand-new member of parliament, an inexperienced member of parliament, who was essentially anointed by the United States to emerge as Venezuela's so-called substitute president. So this is a very dangerous thing that he asserts in the context with all the grandeur of the State of the Union moment.
And that was foreign policy analyst Phyllis Bennis, interviewed by Carmen Berkeley for WBAI on Tuesday night. And the City of Brotherly Love and the Trump administration are on a collision course over supervised drug consumption sites. Philadelphia wants to open a supervised consumption site, also known as a safe injection site, where people could use illicit drugs under medical supervision to help deal with the city's deadly opioid epidemic. But the Trump administration, particularly the U.S. Department of Justice under Attorney General Jeff Sessions and Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein, claims that such sites violate federal law and it could potentially arrest anyone involved in opening a site.
I'm not aware of any valid basis for the argument that you can engage in criminal activity as long as you do it in the presence of somebody with a medical license. This is not a disease that gets spread like the flu. People can only become addicted if they have access to these illegal drugs. And so if we can prevent that access, we can prevent it, an addiction. It remains illegal under federal law, and people engaged in that activity remain vulnerable to civil and criminal enforcement.
Assistant Attorney General Rod Rosenstein. Philadelphia has indicated that it's moving forward with supervised consumption sites anyway. Former Pennsylvania Governor Ed Rendell, a Democrat, is on the board of a nonprofit, Safe House, that plans to run a facility, and he doesn't seem deterred by Rosenstein or the Justice Department. Lindsay LaSalle is Director of Public Health Law Policy for the Drug Policy Foundation. She says there are dozens of cities that are looking at help setting up safe injection sites. She says advocates in Philadelphia have put together a diverse group to support the idea.
Philadelphia was most likely the closest city toward moving forward in actual implementation and operation of a supervised consumption site. A group of advocates in Philadelphia created a nonprofit organization called Safe House, which was intended to operate the proposed site. It has a wide-ranging advisory board, including people from government in Philadelphia, law professors, public health professors, and other folks who work trying to figure out how to operationalize supervised consumption, and had a start date of initially January, but appeared to have been pushed back until about March. So that was their planned opening.
LaSalle adds that despite the Department of Justice action, the federal attorney has not asked for a court injunction, stopping short of preventing the site from opening.
The United States District Court for the Eastern District of Pennsylvania filed a civil action lawsuit seeking declaratory relief that the proposed actions of Safe House, namely the operation of a supervised consumption site, would be illegal under federal law. The U.S. attorney didn't seek an injunction. An injunction would actually prohibit Safe House from operating. So Safe House could choose to operate even if the declaratory judgment wasn't in their favor, but then they would be subject, of course, to criminal penalties, probably an unlikely course of action. I think it's very possible that Safe House prevails. There is good legal precedent. They have good legal defenses that the Federal Controlled Substances Act, based on its legislative history and the legislative intent, was never meant to reach public health interventions like supervised consumption sites, where the intent is to prevent death. In fact, many of the purposes of the Controlled Substances Act are completely compatible with supervised consumption sites, things like research and promoting health and promoting rehabilitation and providing education, all things that supervised consumption sites do. I don't think that it's going to deter other jurisdictions at this moment from moving forward with their own plans for opening supervised consumption sites. They're all authorized a little bit differently, which provides them different legal grounds in all of these different jurisdictions. Ultimately, if there is a negative ruling, that remains to be seen in terms of how advocates on the ground decide to move forward or not. Obviously, medical and recreational cannabis remains illegal under federal law. States continue to authorize, have very robust programs, and there have been political solutions in the interim. So that's certainly a possibility, too, that we see a political solution come out of this.
And Lindsay LaSalle works with the Drug Policy Association. In October, California Governor Jerry Brown vetoed a bill to legalize injection sites in that state because he feared federal authorities would raid the facilities under laws meant to close so-called crack houses, a serious felony with a long prison sentence. Philadelphia, though, is sticking to its guns. Former Governor Rendell has said he's willing to be arrested first if the feds crack down. And women political leaders gathered on the Upper East Side of Manhattan Tuesday night to watch the State of the Union address and the Democratic response delivered by former Georgia gubernatorial candidate Stacey Abrams. Over oysters and fries, they booed and catcalled the president. Jessica Brockington reports.
If I had not been elected president of the United States, we would right now, in my opinion, be in a major war with North Korea.
The event was organized by the Women's Leadership Forum and Tri-State Maxed Out Women. Melissa Mark Viverito, the former speaker of the New York City Council, who's running in the special election for public advocate, left early in disgust.
I mean, this is the most overtly racist State of the Union speech, right? Wants to talk about scapegoating immigrants while we have had white supremacists that have been doing mass killings in this country, and absolutely no mention of that. Talking about ripping children out of the wombs of mothers against a woman's right to choose, but not talking about ripping children away from the arms of mothers or fleeing violence. I mean, it's just overtly racist and scapegoating. It's just really painful to listen to. I mean, I did not come here expecting to listen to the State of the Union. I was here looking to hear Stacey Abrams' response to. And it's really hard to sit through it because it's just, antithetical, right? He wants to talk about the speech was going to be about uniting the nation. This is the most divisive speech I've heard. And it's just, it definitely is a reflection of the State of the Union. We're divided, and we're at one of our worst moments right now, at least in the time that I've been watching these speeches or in terms of the presidents and the administrations that I've been a witness to. It's a terrible time for the United States of America.
Monica Atiyah is a member of Tri-State Maxed Out Women, one of the organizations that sponsored the event.
What I heard mostly was a campaign speech. It seemed more like the rhetoric that he would use for in terms of speaking to his base and inspiring people to vote for him again, rather than to talk about what he's really done or not done in terms of governing.
Helen Rosenthal, city council member for the Upper West Side of Manhattan, was harder on Trump.
He created the divisiveness in our country. And now he's asking us to come together? I mean, he's a bad man.
Stacey Abrams did well with this crowd. A woman who wished to be identified only as Leslie felt Abrams was very grounded.
I thought she brought up some very important points. Voter suppression, climate change, immigration from a more realistic, practical point of view. And she just comes across more genuine. I mean, for me, a lot of it also has to do with the character of both people. So Trump just lost me. The last 2 years, he's just shown himself to not be a very reliable person.
Monica Atiyah agreed.
She, you know, is very much involved with the Fair Fight campaign and the voting rights issue. But she clearly made a message that was truly unifying. They're trying to find those areas in which we can work together, which is really what I think the average American wants.
The rhetoric of Trump's speech drew scorn from the crowd.
You have come from the rocky shores of Maine and the volcanic peaks of Hawaii, from the snowy woods of Wisconsin and the red deserts of Arizona, from the green farms of Kentucky and the golden beaches of California. Together we represent the most extraordinary nation in all of history.
Helen Rosenthal thought he'd had a little help from one great hippie.
Well, didn't it just sound like, you know, the beginning of this land is your land, this land is my land? I think somebody cripped from Pete Seeger. And that wasn't cool. That was not cool.
Gail Brewer, the borough president of Manhattan, also left during Trump's speech. As she left, she said she was most excited by the show of solidarity among women wearing white in Congress.
I mean, I think it's exciting to see the women, because it's not often, to be honest with you, that women in elected office stick together. You hear they do, but they don't actually. And so to see all of those women in white, to me, that means a lot. As somebody who came up through the women's movement, we kind of all fought for that, and there it is. So whatever he says, whatever. But that they're there and they're making a statement, to me, that's the exciting part of tonight.
Jessica Brockington, WBAI News, New York.
And that's some of the news for Wednesday, February 6, 2019. The news is produced with Linda Perry and Jessica Brockington. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson. You can send your comments and questions to paulnews@wbai.org. That's paulnews@wbai.org. For the WBAI Evening News, I'm Paul DiRienzo in New York.